are listening to the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation, a national nonprofit founded on the principle that every pregnancy deserves a happy ending. Find us online at starlegacyfoundation.org. If you like what you hear, please visit iTunes and give this podcast a 5-star rating. Our guest for this episode is Marion Sokol, Executive Director of the Children's Bereavement Center of South Texas. Marion founded and was the executive director of Any Baby Can for 21 years and president of First Candle SIDS Alliance, based in Maryland, for 8 years. She is also currently the co-chair of the Action for Stillbirth Awareness and Prevention Coalition. Marion has a passion for stillbirth prevention and supporting families that experience such tragedies. Well, Marion, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Oh, Chris, you're very welcome, and I thank you for having me.
My first question for you is a very general, broad question before we dive into the specifics, but can you talk a little bit about the Children's Bereavement Center of South Texas, what it is, and what is its mission?
Right. We are one of about 170 bereavement centers across the country that are dedicated to working with children who have been affected by the death of a loved one. And so usually this is the death of a parent, a brother, or sister. Some of the centers extend their work to include those children who are grieving incarcerated parents or parents who have been divorced. But here in San Antonio, we work with over 1,200 children a year who are affected by death of a parent or a loved one. And when I say we work with them, Chris, that includes individual counseling, support groups, camps for children, and also crisis response out in schools.
When you say there's 170 just like this across the country, are all 170 of these bereavement centers affiliated with one another, or are they separate entities?
They're actually all part of a national network called the National Alliance for Grieving Children. And you can find that online, NAGC, for Grieving Children. They do good, they all do good work. We meet once a year in an annual conference. You have to meet certain standards to be admitted as a center. Ours is one of the larger, I'd say probably in the top five in the country in terms of size. We actually have now 4 different locations, one where we're working with families where there's a devastating diagnosis. So if there's a diagnosis of cancer, ALS or Parkinson's, we work there with those children. We have a center in the Rio Grande Valley near the Texas border, and one, our most recent center, has just been opened in the area of Sutherland Springs after the mass shooting there in the church last November.
You know, one of the things you hear a lot of people say is, when there's a loss of a family member or a child or a stillbirth, oftentimes you look at the older siblings, and that's one of the first things people say is, oh man, I can't imagine what is going on with so-and-so, the older sibling. This is really heavy, really, really challenging work. I'm curious, what draws you to this type of work?
I've always, I guess my entire career has been dedicated to children. And in 1982 in San Antonio, I ended up part of a group that wrote a concept paper to create a crisis center for children in need. And we were able to get funding for that. I was a very young college professor at the time, quit my job to take over and to run this center. And I was amazed at how families adapt to children with special needs, because the majority of children coming into these crisis center were children that had medical complexity and disabilities. But I was amazed as the children progressed how beloved most of them came, and how the family in many cases saw the disability as just a blessing to their family. What hurt the most, I think, were those families that came in that had lost a child to SIDS and stillbirth. We very soon became involved in providing cemetery plots and in creating a rotation of funeral homes in our community that would bury the children at no cost. And so I think it was this sense of just hopelessness and guilt many times if there was a SIDS or a stillbirth. So after I left that center a good 21 years later, I ended up taking a job as president of the National Sudden Infant Death Alliance as we were expanding to encompass stillwork, stillbirth. So that has very much been part of my work, part of my life, and really a large part of my heart. We see some of those families here in San Antonio, and I'm also very involved in the local coalition providing safe cribs for babies.
What is the age range of children you work with at the Children's Bereavement Center of South Texas?
We actually work with children ages 3 through 23, which, you know, you're not really a child, I guess, after 18 or maybe 21. But the founders of our center back in 1997, many of them had lost parents when they were in high school or college and found that to have profound impact on their life. So we have a wide range. Usually after age 16 or 17, most all the work we do is individual counseling, although we do run support groups twice a month. That we, our whole center is open for teens in the area. We bring in pizza and they have the center for an evening support group. So pretty wide range. Our 3 to 5 year olds, we run a pretty thriving program there. We'll have 7 to 10 at any given time, and they usually come in for 8 weeks or so. That's the only program we do during the day. Our philosophy here is that if a child is old enough to love, they're old enough to grieve. And we do have a number of children whose dad has been in the military, didn't come home. We certainly have those children who have been in the care of a grandma or grandpa, and that person has been the primary caregiver for the child during the day, as in many families that happens nowadays while mom and dad go to work. So we really have, I guess, both ends of the continuum. And I might not have mentioned before, Chris, that we encompass the parent or the caregiver as well. So we have support groups for the families that go on, for the adults, when the children also are engaged in their activities.
What are some of the most common questions or concerns that you get from parents when they're concerned about their grieving children?
Well, I think invariably adults want to fix it. They want to stop or speed up the grieving process. And that's usually, you know, how can I help? What can I do so that he'll get over it or she'll get over it? And we stress to the families that grief is a journey. And we try to educate them that what the child is going through is very normal and that they have to get through it, not over it. I think a lot of the common questions are regarding funerals. Should the child go to the funeral? And, you know, our view is absolutely if the child wants to go. And in saying that, we recognize that children sometimes cannot sit for long periods of time, especially when they're stressed. But they can, you know, if you have an adult there that can remove them, if they're not ready to be there, that's probably the best option. We always tell the adults that adults model behavior for the child. If the parent is outwardly very distraught, that of course usually makes the child much more stressed, versus a parent who's saying, I don't understand why this happened, but you're okay and I'm okay and we're going to figure this out together. I think developmental age is very important. You have to not tell the child everything. On the other hand, we really encourage the parents to be very truthful. We've seen so many children that are confused and upset, especially if there's been something that has happened to a family member where there's self-harm or violence, and it's, you know, there's an attempt to hide it from the child, because children nowadays are very savvy. They use the internet, they look things up. I had one family come recently, and this was a family that was just experiencing a devastating diagnosis for dad of a stage 4 cancer. And their question was, should we tell our daughter, who's in fifth grade, that dad has cancer? Well, the child already knew dad had a tumor, already knew dad had surgery, and the other children in the class were starting to ask this little girl, does your dad have cancer? So, you know, some of the questions to us seem fairly obvious, be as truthful as possible. But again, we temper that according to the developmental age of the child, and always want to be available to answer questions.
You know, I think it's fascinating that so many parents, they feel the need to want to fix, speed up the grieving process, and make sure that this loss doesn't, for lack of a better term, ruin this child for the rest of their life, or deeply impact them so much that it hurts their life. What type of advice would you give to a family who has recently experienced a stillbirth or a similar death to help the other children in the family?
I think, again, opening communication is really important. Being able to talk with your child, being honest with your child, not being afraid to say, I don't understand either why something like this happened, but, you know, we're going to do the best we can, and you're safe. Just reassuring the child. Giving the child the language to speak to them about emotions. We carry out our program here primarily through expressive arts. We don't have a psychologist sit across the couch from the child. All of our therapists are trained masters and doctoral level individuals, professionals, but they very much engage the child in play. And we teach them to talk about how they feel. We do that in part by having them draw, you know, create masks. We have masks that on one side the child expresses or colors or creates how they think the world looks at them and sees them. And on the inside of the mask, they create how they really feel. We do lots of artwork with canvases, and we ask them, how does your heart feel? And so if you go upstairs and look in our art studio, there are lots of cracked hearts and broken hearts and hearts with a dark circle in the middle. We give them things like water balloons. They go out in the garden and they fill up water balloons and they smash them against a wall. And we talk about, you know, what makes you mad? And they'll many times talk about, you know, the illness that took away their child, or the fact that they don't have a baby sister at home anymore. We carry that even to another level in that we have a padded room, literally our rumpus room, with padded walls and a huge stuffed doll that's probably about 8 foot tall that they punch around and throw against the wall. And that can be whatever they want it to be. It can be the drunk driver that killed mom or dad. It can be cancer. It can be just the fact that they're angry because they had a baby sister and now they don't anymore. So again, talking about emotions, labeling emotions, and giving them the language. We see a fair number of families here where there's been a suicide, and we don't talk, we model the language that this is a death by suicide. We don't say mom committed suicide or, you know, dad committed suicide. We talk about death by suicide as a way of dying, because we don't want them to believe that this was something that the parent planned to take, you know, go away from them, to commit and willfully did. we explain that sometimes when the body doesn't feel right, doesn't work right, they don't think as they usually would, and they do something that hurts the body. So it's more that something has happened to them.
So I'd like to talk about this a little bit more. You've touched on the expressive arts, the playing, drawing, mm-hmm. talking about emotions, mm-hmm. but are there any other activities or specific tangible things you do with grieving children at the bereavement center to help them through the grieving process?
Mm-hmm. We have a drama studio. We have dress up in the drama studio. We have outfits for firemen and policemen. If you come into our playrooms, you'll see all the typical things in a playroom, but you'll also see moats and castles so that they can talk about whether they have fear. Sometimes children are afraid that they're not safe or that they may die as well. We do the same thing in our devastating diagnosis center. We provide them with a little doll that has IVs and a catheter you can change out so that they can talk and explore all of those fears and concerns. We have a sand tray room, and all along the wall there are little figures where they can create their own story. Had a little boy in one of our centers the first day he came. He reenacted, found everything to do with military flags and tanks, and created a barracks. And he was remembering his dad the way he wanted to remember his dad. Interestingly, this dad did die, but it was in a traffic accident. However, dad was in the military. And the way this little boy wants to remember his dad right now is as a hero in a military setting, and he was playing that out in the sand tray. More traditionally, we do letters and journals, and in our camps we decorate photo frames. Each child brings a picture, and we talk about that. Every child gets a teddy bear. I've seen teenagers choose one of the little ones and stuff it in their pocket. So there's a lot of, you know, comfort. We serve meals every night when the children come to our center. We believe very much that breaking bread and sharing with other families can be a healing experience. And many of our families who leave here become close and remain close. I think support groups, whether it's a stillbirth specific or sudden infant death or death in general, that there is a bond there. In fact, that is such a core philosophy of ours that all of our groups are, when they first come to our center for an intake, essentially they're divided into one of four categories, whether it's been a sudden death, a death due to chronic illness, a death due to suicide, or a death due to violence or homicide. Because we really, I don't like the word normalizing, but it is true. When you know someone who has experienced something similar, there's that bond and trust and degree of relationship that it doesn't come even many times from professionals comparatively.
Earlier in our conversation, you very poetically stated that grief is a journey, and I know this to be true, as many others do. Grief does not have an end date. That said, mm-hmm. is there a certain period of time where it seems like the services of the bereavement center are needed the most? Is it within the first 6 months of a loss, the first year of a loss? What have you found?
Mm-hmm. Oh, we truly believe it's the first year. It's all those milestone occasions. The first birthday that the person you love isn't there, the death date, Mother's Day. I once had a stillbirth mother that I respect highly say to me that she never realized how child-centered our society was until she lost her baby. And then she realized that families plan summer vacations around their children. They look forward to Christmas in large part because of, you know, seeing the world through the eyes of a child at Christmas. Easter, you know, you're looking for dress up. it's just a cascade. Even Halloween, it's just a cascade of holidays and special family times that are not the same after you've lost a child. And finding some way to memorialize that child is really important. I had a colleague who had lost a baby to sudden infant death, and for 20 years, every Christmas, each of the other two children wrote and made little gifts on notes for that child and put notes in a stocking for the child that was still hung on the fireplace. So incorporating somehow the person you love into the family as, you know, a lasting part of your family. We see that in Mexican culture, of course, with Day of the Dead, where it's something where the Hispanic families actually honor and bring favorite foods and incorporate into their living family those who have passed before them. But getting back more specifically, Chris, one of the things here in terms of getting help for a child, we encourage the family to get through the funeral first. We really think that during those first days after the death, the children need to be surrounded by those they love. I've had calls from parents who say, can you, you know, send one of your counselors out to our house? The boys are in the bedroom crying. And this is on the day that the death occurred. Well, that's not appropriate. You know, these young boys don't want a stranger walking into their bedroom. The children need to hear the news and be reassured by the people around them who love them. Now, we certainly will speak with the parents and counsel them on how best to talk to the child, maybe some books that they can get to read for little ones. But we think that period from about 3 weeks after the death, when things have settled down again, through the first year, is very much a time where we want to be involved and hope to be involved in that family's life.
We talked about the sensitivities and challenges of a suicide earlier. Since the majority of the people who listen to this podcast are people who have been personally affected by stillbirth or pregnancy loss, I want to focus on that for a minute. It can be really challenging for people to cope with deaths that carry a stigma alongside it. And we know that pregnancy and infant deaths often have a stigma attached to it. How do children respond to the stigma they may encounter? What advice do you have? What have you noticed in terms of the stigma attached to stillbirth and pregnancy loss?
Again, I think so much of how the child reacts is modeled after how the parents and the loved ones around them are reacting. Death is very disenfranchising. It can cause a crisis in your faith. It can impact marriage. It can impair your parenting. And in the case of a stillbirth or sudden infant death, there of course is that search right away of what did I do, what did I cause. Sometimes the media, I guess it's just, you know, because they are media, get involved. We had the situation in San Antonio this past week. I still don't know the outcome, but there was the death of a little two-year-old in a child care center, and police were out. It was on the news. There still has not been a ruling. And there most likely are not many families to know that out there is something, you know, classified as sudden unexpected death of a child, very similar to SIDS, but it happens after age one. There are a few hundred cases that are being tracked on a registry in California. So dealing with stigma and dealing with loss, you know, the implication that someone must have done something because the pregnant mom looked totally healthy, all of that is really, really difficult. I think more than anything else, people need support individually and support together as a family unit. It's just such a difficult journey. Getting pregnant right away again doesn't fix it, but I will say through the years, I have seen many, many families have what they call rainbow babies and still respect and love the baby they lost, still absolutely claim, you know, when they look at how many children they have, they don't at all deny that they're still parent of that child that they love who's no longer on earth. So I wish there were an easy answer. Listening, caring, not asking if they help, but finding little ways to help. You know, traditionally, it's like drop-off dinner, and that's fine at first. But if there are just some ways that you can be a friend who listens, and a friend who's there for the long haul, not for the first 10 days, that's really important. And using the child's name, of course. Every baby has a name, and that name usually comes, you know, months before birth when the parent does that incredibly happy search, because that's just a part of who they are. Respecting that, going to the funeral, understanding when someone is not up to doing something. There's not a beginning, a clear, I guess, beginning to some of the grief that occurs, because some of it happens or it sets in, I guess, after everyone goes home after the funeral, that nagging loneliness, that empty nursery. Just being understanding and being present, being a friend.
Marian, just a couple more questions. My first one is, I know that you are an extremely busy person and you also find time to serve on the board of the Star Legacy Foundation. I'm curious, what drew you to this organization to serve as a board member? Why do you find this work important? Because I know that you probably have a lot of other things going on and a lot of other opportunities to serve on boards across the country.
Right. I think it's both the numbers of families affected and the impact of that loss. When you look in terms of numbers, there are, you know, there are, I think it's 70 stillbirths a day, 28,000 stillbirths in our country of babies that would have had a chance at life if we had just known the baby was experiencing difficulty. This to me is just, you know, profound, that these are classrooms of little ones that aren't going to kindergarten to, you know, to first grade. And they're just broken hearts, broken marriages. And to think that there are some things that we can do that are preventable, that to me has always been something really exciting about the work of Star Legacy. There are a lot of people that do bereavement across the country, but Star Legacy does more than that. We're looking at prevention. We're looking at tracking through a birth registry to see if we can find commonalities among those babies that have not survived. I think there's incredible energy. The leadership, Lindsay Wimmer and her mother are just absolutely amazing people. Shauna Lipsack and Lindsay have really set the bar for organizations that are well-run, passionate, developed a national board. And when other people were saying you can't do that, they were saying, why not? So I love the energy. I love the people involved with it. But most of all, I think the mission's incredibly important. And although the work I do now is sort of tangential here at our center in Texas, stillbirth families and sudden infant death families are still something that just take my breath away. I think a baby is a miracle. And if we can in any way detect that that child is, you know, in trouble in utero and successfully fix that, deliver early, whatever, that that is just the gift of a lifetime.
Marian, how can people across the country find the Children's Bereavement Center closest to them?
They can just Google National Alliance for Grieving Children. And there's also a National Alliance for Gifted Children, I might mention. So you might put in NAGC-grief, but it will come up. But National Alliance for Grieving Children. And just click the page that says resources. You'll find a statewide map. It's really easy. Click on your city, and you'll be able to see if there's a grief support center there.
Well, Marian, the work you're doing for children in South Texas, and the work you're doing also for the Star Legacy Foundation is so impressive and so appreciated. And I want to thank you for taking the time to appear on the podcast today.
Well, my honor, Chris. Thank you. We don't talk enough about infant death. It's difficult because it's a painful subject, but families need to know this. And mothers who are expecting need to know how to take care of themselves. So if you go onto the website of the Star Legacy Foundation and look at the material they have, there's good information there about how to have a healthy pregnancy. We want to reach those where there has been a death, but we also want to make sure that every mom who's expecting a child, every dad who's expecting a child, knows how to best take care of that infant in utero during that important 9 months, probably the most important 9 months in our entire lifetime.
Absolutely. Thank you for your time, Marian.
You're welcome, Chris. Enjoy speaking with you.
That's all for this episode of the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation. I'm Chris Duffy. Thanks for listening.